called fixed, and this is what is called the toothed coupling. Okay, then we saw that perturbation theory organizes itself as a genus as a sum over surfaces of a given genus. And what do we mean by these pictures? We mean that there is a sum over the genus from, say, 0 to infinity, G string to 2 genus minus 2, and then some function for each genus, which will depend on lambda and on all these details of the theory, but which are of order, parameters of order 1. Okay? So for example, F0 is equal to the sum of all planar diagrams, all diagrams that can be drawn on a sphere, and so on. Okay? Here I wrote the original action, which we used during the lecture, and this was the action that you used during the tutorial. Did everyone do this tutorial? Yeah? So it's clear the counting. There's no point in going over these arguments of why with this new action you get, of course, the same thing. You just rescale the field. Okay. So is there any question about this point of the tutorial? I think this is probably the most important question, which was asked in the tutorial, to really understand this expansion and so on. So you redid it using different conventions. You got the same result. So is everyone happy with the large n limits and with the organization in topologies? Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes. So before, like when you were just writing it down, it wasn't clear where you got gs to the power of e. From each contribution of each.
Here? Or here?
Here.
Yeah. Okay. Let's do this count. So let's do the counting again, because this is really important. I'm sorry to repeat, but let's do the counting with action 1. With action 1, we have g strings to the power e from propagators. Each propagator, there is 1 over g string in a kinetic term, so the inverse of this matrix has g string upstairs. Right? Recall that each propagator is what? It's the inverse of the kinetic term. So if you have 1 over g string here, the average of m contains g string. Then we have g string to the power minus v from the vertices. And then we have n to the f from the color loops. In the second action, the counting is a bit different. Now the propagators give nothing. They always give 1. There's nothing from the propagators. From the vertices now, whenever we have a vertex, we have a g string to the p over 2 minus 1 times how many vertices there are with this p, and we have product over p. Right? This is how many vertices there are with p legs. So each vertex contributes with g string to p over 2 minus 1 after you rescale. Right? And then there are loops, so n to the f. And now what is this? This is g string to the power minus sum of vertices p times g string to the sum over p vertices p over 2. Right? What is the sum over vertices p? This is just g string to the minus v, like here. What is this sum? What is this sum here? So each vertex, say this is sum v8, right? So if I multiply 8 times the number of vertices with 8, or if I multiply p times the number of vertices, I count how many edges are leaving vertices. How many guys are leaving? I have v8 times 8, it's how many are leaving vertices of 8. But whenever one edge leaves one vertex, it must end on some other vertex. So if I just multiply p times vp, I'm overcounting the number of edges by a factor of 2. So sum of p times vp in a graph overcounts the number of edges by 2. And since we divide by 2, we get the number of edges which was here. Okay? So if you count p times vp, you are overcounting the number of edges by a factor of 2. Because each edge is counted from this guy and from this guy. So it appears twice in this counting. Okay, very good. And then we used Euler identity to show that this was equivalent to this, where G is the genus, which is related to how many handles your surface has. So in the beginning, when I asked you what would you like as parameters to characterize the graph, some of you immediately proposed the handles. We see that in this logic that we are following, the handles appear at the very end. Very good. Now, let's consider something which looks more like, again, this is a toy model. If this was a field theory, these matrices would depend on the position. The propagator would not only depend on the color, but there would be stuff which depends on the position, 1 over the distance square or 1 over p square. But the n counting is exactly the same. So this is very generic. It holds for any gauge theory. Here we are only focusing on the color structure, on getting these factors of n and so on, right? So let's consider something which looks a bit more like the kind of things we have in field theory. Let's consider a correlator between two single trace operators. So in this case, two traces of matrices. So let me just one. Okay, so let's compute the correlation function of, say, trace of m to the 4 with trace of m to the 4. Just one important thing. Whenever we consider averages, we have an action which is gauge invariance. M could go to u times m to u minus 1, right? This left the action invariant. So it's good to consider observables that are gauge invariant so that we get sensible answers, right? And indeed, this is gauge invariant. It's invariant under m goes to u, m, u minus 1. So these are examples of good observables, good things that we can ask our theory. So let's consider just this connected part of this diagram. So let's consider that we have this, the first field. Let me draw it like this. So this is the first, this is this one. Then we have the second one here. Okay, this is the second one. And let's just compute, let's just put some propagators here between the two. Okay. And now, from now on, I don't want to use this fat line anymore. I think everyone understood what's the idea. Lines cannot cross and so on. So instead of this diagram, I can always draw just this. And you understand very well that you have to fatten any line. Right? Okay, because we know that we have to fatten. So for example, I would draw. So now we change. Let's change. And keeping in mind the fat line notation. So if I have something, for example, like this, that I was drawing before, for example, and this, I would simply now write as this. And if I have something non-planar, for example, something like this line going below this other one, I would simply draw it, say that I have like this, and I have like this, and I stop, and I continue here to indicate that it went below the other one. Okay? So it's simple to fatten these diagrams. Is it clear to everyone? Just so that we don't lose so much time. We have to count the propagators and so on. It's a bit annoying. Okay, very good. So, but let's see this diagram. Let's do this counting one. So this diagram goes like how many faces we have? 1, 2, 3, and the exterior one, 4. So this one goes like n to the 4. And therefore, I want to normalize my operators. So let me consider my operators with 1 over n squared, 1 over n squared, and then times 1 over n squared squared. So now this simple free contraction is normalized to be of order 1. Okay? Just so that it has a good large n limit. Okay? And then, okay. And let's call this our operator O. Okay. Now, if we start putting O with O, so this is the connected part and also free. It's in the Gaussian model. So no interactions. If you now start putting interactions, what you get is something like, let's draw something like this. And then you have, say, some interaction here. Okay? Just so that we see that we understand how many loops we have now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we have, so let me write just the result. And it's very simple to check. This one would go like, let's just see, 1 second. So 3 halves minus 1, 1 half. This would go like lambda. Okay, let's. So if this is normalized in this way, this, there's no n dependence. Let me just work out. 1 second. So. Okay, so it's very simple. Let's see. There's no n dependence. Let's see. So we have edges minus vertices. So how many edges we have? 1, 2, 3. So edges is equal 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Vertices is equal to 2. Ah, no, sorry. Sorry. This is just wrong. Ah, now it matters which one I'm using. Okay, sorry. 3, 3 half, 3. Yeah, this one would go like lambda. Okay. Please check. I mean, I should have done it carefully, but I think it goes like lambda. So the idea is that this guy will then be some non-trivial function of lambda. And recall what was the picture was that this lambda, you could think of it as some sort of string tension. That is, you sum over the, you have a string perturbative expansion. This would be the string coupling. But then, even if you have just 2 points propagating, which you can think like you have a string propagating from one point to the other, this string can see vibrates. And this gives this function of lambda, which is related to the sum of all possible planar diagrams like this. So the sum of all possible planar diagrams would give something like this function of lambda. Okay. So let's just do something very simple, which is to consider the correlation function of 4 such operators. Okay?
Here?
Yeah,
sorry.
So this will be connected,
but
in
the interaction.
Okay. I apologize. Sorry. Good. Now let's consider 4 of them. Okay? So what I'm trying to sell you is this idea that this looks like a propagation, if you want, of a string. So this is like a world sheet, this is a plane, and this world sheet is propagating from here to here. And there can be many diagrams and so on, and provided it's planar, it's describing just the propagation of a string from this point to this other point. So now let's see. So this is just is what the formulas are telling us, that we have this planar graphs, then we have a string with one hole, then we have a string with two holes, and so on, propagating from one point to the other. So the idea is that its O is somehow associated to one string, or if you want, one particle. And let's see how this makes sense if we consider these 4 points. So now, if we have these 4, how should I do? So I have this one, I want to contract this guy, and this guy. Okay? Now, notice something important. One way of contracting is just by saying this one goes here, this one goes here, this one goes here, and then these ones go here, like this. Okay? Now, this diagram here is nothing but the disconnected part where O goes to O, O goes to O. Right? By the diagram. Now, each O to O, O to O, it's of order 1. So this diagram here is of order 1, because we normalize the operator so that the two-point function is of order 1. Okay? Plus, then we can have something like this. Other diagrams where we have these four. We have these four. And we have, say, an interaction between the two. And now you see what is happening. What is happening is that because of this interaction, you lost one boundary. You lost one color loop. Here there was one exterior color loop, and here another exterior color loop. But now you connected, so now there's only one exterior color loop. Right? So, so these diagrams here are suppressed at large n. Let me just see one thing. Sorry. So what by which power of n are they suppressed? I'm just confused by some. So let's see. One. Sorry? Yeah, it's
n squared from the features. Say which I shouldn't have gone to this. I should have kept that as one.
Yeah, so there is also another one that you do when you connect the two bubbles inside. So if you consider the
good, very good, very good. Awesome. So let's see. So and indeed I was confused now. This is 1/n². And indeed as we may say, so it's easier to see. I shouldn't have gone to. Let's do it with still in the double line notation with trace of n². It's simple. We have a trace of n² going to a trace of n². And here another trace of n² going to another trace of n². Okay? And now compare this by the case where you decide to do this, this. Okay.
No. 1, 2, 3. Sorry? For the argument, actually, it's not important. I know the result is 1/n². I apologize. From what I'm drawing, it looks like 1/n, but it really doesn't matter. So what I want to say is that what happens is that in the large n limit, when n goes to infinity, okay, correlation functions of single trace operators factorize. So when n goes to infinity, you get just O, 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 which is just this contraction, plus, so this is just this free, plus connecting them in this way. Okay, it will also be this one with this one, or this one with this one. so? Ah, very good, very good. I understand. Very good. Sorry. Ah, oof. Ah, how stupid. So, awesome. Very good. So, let's recall the limit that we want to carry. G string goes to zero, n goes to infinity, g string times n is fixed. So I cannot just count loops. I should see what are the g strings. So here I have a g string to the power 1/2, and here a g string to the power 1/2, or minus 1/2 probably. So it's p over 2 minus 1, so p is 3, so I have 3/2 minus 1, so it's 1/2. Right? You agree? Yes? So what is these two guys together? These guys, they are g strings times n, this is fixed, times 1 over n. This is lambda. Okay? So this graph, indeed, is just given. There is an interaction, so there is a coupling. But the important part is the n squared, which I want to cut, is indeed lambda over n squared. Okay? Sorry about that. Okay, good. Okay. Very good. So this is a very important point. It means that in any, and this is true for, again, for any gauge theory. So in any gauge theory, what happens is that in the large n limits, correlation functions of gauge invariant operators factorize. Whenever they can be disconnected, they prefer to be disconnected, because by being disconnected, you get more boundaries. So you really see this picture, this natural picture, that if you think that each single trace is like a string, then you can have the strings propagating freely, or they can interact. Imagine by exchanging a graviton, you can think, or something like that. And of course, those interactions are suppressed. So naively, they just want to propagate, and then there are corrections to this propagation, which are this 1 over n effects. So you can think of this as free propagation, and correction, interaction between the two strings. Okay? So it's the strings, first order, they don't notice each other, they just propagate freely, and the 4-point function factorizes into 2-point functions, and then you have corrections where these two guys start interacting. And again, this is very generic. In any gauge theory, you consider QCD when n is very large, you have these gauge invariant operators, each of them you can think of a string, and then there are 1 over n corrections and so on that become suppressing this interaction. Okay, very good. So now I want to consider two applications of these matrix models and of this large n limit. Just two nice physical applications which illustrate that indeed this is something that we can encounter in many circumstances. And I want to start by two-dimensional quantum gravity, where what we want to do is to consider some partition function, which is some integral over the matrix of two-dimensional matrices. Okay. So we sum over the genus. Let me write genus because I'm already using G for the metric. And then I have some exponential, some action of minus, let me parameterize, beta times A plus gamma times chi. So let me explain what these are. Where chi is just 1, this is not a convention, notation, 1 over 4 pi integral square root of g times the Ricci scalar. Okay. And A is integral of square root of g over these surfaces. So we integrate over the matrices. We integrate over genus, we sum over genus gamma surfaces. We sum over the genus, sorry. The surface is gamma, so this is the surface. So we want to consider this path integral over all possible surfaces, and this is the action that we would write. We have just some usual Einstein-Hilbert term, and then we can have a term which just measures the area of the surface. And you would interpret this one as just measuring the area of the surface, if you think for a while. if you see what equations, what it would normally lead to if you would plug such term in the action, would give some cosmological constant. So you can think as this term as a cosmological constant. And as you know, in two dimensions, gravity is contains no propagating degrees of freedom. This term is actually topological. So normalized in this way, chi is nothing but 2 times the genus minus 2, or minus this, I don't know if yeah, minus this, is minus chi is 2 times the genus minus 2. Okay? Yeah.
Beta and gamma?
Beta and gamma are 2 parameters. So this, so A is just the genus of the surface, A is just the area of the surface, chi is just related to its topology, and these are the parameters, the free parameters. So our goal is to compute, if you want, this partition function which depends on this beta and gamma. Okay. So what is the idea, what is one idea to addressing this problem of summing over all possible two-dimensional spacetimes? One nice idea is to triangulate. And let me, I should have drawn this picture before starting, it's not an easy one. So let me suppose I triangulate this. So you can try to draw any triangulation. Tack, tack, tack. It's just... So let's just triangulate. I think probably maybe this will be enough. Something like that. You triangulate your spacetime. And the idea is that you will replace, you will consider that if you have many triangles meeting in a, if you think that all triangulars are, think that all triangles are equilateral, then if you want to have something flat, how many triangles you need meeting at a point? 6. So if you have 6 triangles, this is exactly what you draw if all of them are equilateral. If you have more than 6 triangles, or less than 6 triangles, it means that you have curvature, which can be positive or negative. And indeed, a discretization of this chi, of this integral, of square root of g times r, would be precisely, you sum over all your possible over all your possible vertices, why did I put 4? All your possible vertices, and then you have this 4 pi, and you have 1 minus the lines getting out of the vertex over 6. Okay. Let's see that indeed this reproduces this 2 genus minus 2. So let's see that this is something reasonable. So the logic is, we know that this is this because we know that gravity in two dimensions is topological, so this is our starting point. And I want to claim that a nice way of getting this is by summing over this quantity. This is like the curvature, because as I said, if you have more or less than 6, means that you have curved. If you have exactly 6 triangles, that point is flat. So let's see. First, so to compute this sum, we need two things. We need, so, sum over I up to V of 4 pi. Okay, this one is easy, right? It's 4 pi times v. Then we need the other one, sum from I equal 1 up to v of 4 pi over 6 with a minus times n I. Okay, so we need to compute this. Now this is a reasoning very similar to the one we did in the tutorial. let me write two equations and then we check why they are correct. So now, we have the 2e, 2 times the number of edges, is equal to the sum over I of ni. Why is this true? This is exactly the argument of the tutorial, right? If we sum the number of edges emanating from a vertex, we count the number of edges, but we overcount by a factor of 2 because each line starts at a vertex and goes to another vertex. And also, 2 times the number of edges is equal to 3 times the number of faces. Okay. Why is this true? This is true because each face has 3 edges, and each edge is shared by 2 faces. Okay? And therefore, this sum, if we put everything together, is just minus 4 pi times f over 2. And therefore, this quantity that we want to compute, let's call it something like this, is equal to 4 pi v. You can also write it in this way, v minus e plus f. It's another way of writing. And this is precisely 4 pi times chi. This is just the Euler identity. OK, very good. Why is this related at all with matrix models? Why is this related at all with some large n limit and some matrix model? And the idea is that you can build these triangulations. You can think of the dual graph of these triangulations. And I can map you a triangulation to a Feynman graph that you would get in a matrix model. So let me show you how it works. It's simpler to show than to explain in great detail. The idea, I hope I can draw here, is that each line, you draw a propagator, a matrix model propagator, crossing each line. Now let's see. Now they have this line, so another one crosses this line. You have this line, another one crosses this line. You have this one, another line crosses this one. And you go on like this. So let's try. You see? Here it is. So you see that summing over these triangulations is nothing but summing over a matrix model where you draw, this is a typical Feynman diagram of a matrix model. What kind of matrix model? Sorry? Cubic.
Why cubic? Because you see all vertices are just cubic vertices. Three edges, three edges, and so on, because each triangle, because it's a triangulation. So whenever you have a point, if I say that each edge is crossed by a line, it crossed. There are three edges for each triangle, and therefore, it should be a matrix model.
And indeed, now we have to understand what's the mapping between these parameters and the parameters of the matrix model. Let me just write it, and then you can check more carefully that indeed it works. Okay, so this partition function, e to the z, is nothing indeed but the integral over the matrix model, e to the minus 1 half trace of m square plus g over square root of n trace of m cube, provided we identify n to be related to this e to the gamma and g to be related to e to the minus beta. Okay? And you see that from the picture, and let me leave it as an exercise to check the details, but let me say a few words. Why it is very natural. So first, N was is can be a genus expansion. We saw that the diagrams are further and further suppressed by N. And indeed, N measures precisely the genus. And beta is related to the area. And indeed, beta is related to the vertex. So if you have a surface with many, many vertices, you have a surface with a lot of area. So it's very natural to have this identification. And you can work out, if you want, in more detail and check that indeed this works. And you see that this Z would be given by some N square times some planar diagrams, which will depend on G, plus some Z1 that will depend on G, plus some Z2 that will depend on G over N square, plus that, like that. Okay, and this will be the sphere, and so on. Okay, so this is one example that I wanted to show you, that summing over these triangulations is one example, if we need to sum over triangulations, where matrix models and this large n-limit technology can be very useful. Any question here? Otherwise, I want to give you another example. Okay, think if you have any question while I erase this. Otherwise, I want to move to another example. This is the other example I want to show you is an example from statistical physics. I want to consider the Ising model, the two-dimensional Ising model on a random surface. Okay, so the partition function of the Ising model in a fixed surface, in a fixed lattice, what is it? So what's the partition function of the Ising model? So we have some fixed lattice, let's say some, can be some square lattice, and at each point, we have a sigma which can take the value up or down, or plus minus 1. And to compute this partition function, we sum over all possible configurations. And then we have e to the minus inverse temperature, then a coupling, j over 2. An interaction between all connections, A and B, these are all edges, all connections. Sigma A, sigma B minus 1, say, for example. Okay, so if they are the same, okay. In my notes, I put 1 minus this. So, okay, doesn't matter. Yeah, let me put a plus. So there is nothing if they are, if both are the same, there's nothing. If they are different, there is some energy cost. Okay, and then we can have some magnetic field, some beta H, which wants to align the spins, and you sum over A sigma A. Okay, so this would be like a spin coupling. And this is, of course, a magnetic field. Very good. And of course, you know that these Ising models on these lattices, if you want to consider large distance behavior of correlation function or thermodynamic quantities and so on, it's not important that the lattice is a square lattice. Many models will be in the same universality class when you take the continuum limits. In the same way, I'm going now to define what the Ising model on the random lattice is. And again, roughly any interactions will do the job. And they would all be in the same universality class as this one. So what would be, how would we define the partition function of the Ising model on a random surface? what would it be? So now the picture, let's first draw the picture. What do we want? We want to say that the surface can be in a sphere. The lattice could be in a sphere, with again some plus or minus at each side. Okay? And we want to sum over up and down for each side. But the surface could also be, the surface has the right to oscillate. It could also be in a torus. And again, we have the spin, but now the lattice is in a non-trivial topology of the torus. Plus, dot, dot, dot. So more exactly, what do we want? We want something like this. We have a sum over the genus. Something like n over 2 minus 2 genus. This is what we want. Then we can say, suppose this guy has n lattice points. Okay? We might want to fix the number of lattice points, or alternatively, we may put a chemical potential for the lattice points. Okay? So let's do it. Let's sum over how many lattice points they have, 1 up to infinity, and we can average with some chemical potential that we can then control if we want to have a saddle point and fix it. Put some beta just. Then we sum, okay, over then we sum over the surfaces with n points and genus G. We sum over all possible surfaces. Then we sum over the configurations, sigma A at each side is equal to plus minus 1, and then exactly the same Hamiltonian. E to the minus, B over 2, J, sum over the connections, now they are different for different surfaces, 1 minus sigma A, sigma B, minus beta H, sum over A of sigma A. Okay? So this is our definition. We want to compute this object. Okay? Does it sound trivial to compute? Sound hard. The claim, again. And let's, again, I leave it as an exercise. I just want to give you an example to check that indeed it will work. I'll just tell you what the result is, and then let's say some words about why indeed it's plausible and why indeed it looks like it has any chance of working. So what is the claim is that, again, this is completely solved by a matrix model, which is a two-matrix model where we integrate over two matrices, A and B, and then we have the following action for the matrix model, exponential, minus trace. And then I want to consider the following kinetic term, A square plus B square minus 2 e to the minus beta j times AB over a number which is 1 minus e to the minus 2 beta j. Okay? This is the kinetic term. It's not diagonal in A and B, but it rather mixes A and B, the matrix A and B. Then there is minus e to the minus beta mu over n trace of e to the minus beta h times a to the 4 plus e to the beta h times b to the 4. And this is the final result. If we compute this matrix model, we sum over all the possible planar diagrams, for example, it gives us the g equal to 0. We sum over all diagrams with topology of a torus, it gives us g equal to 1, and so on. Okay. Let's see why this sounds reasonable. Let's see why this could work. just one thing. So this is an Ising model on a fixed lattice. This is an Ising model on a random lattice with, I still want to fix something, with coordination number 4. Just for simplicity, this is why I put a to the 4. The lattice can be random, but there are always 4 vertices getting out of each. There are always 4 lines getting out of each vertex. Okay? Sorry?
In the North Pole, you have all these lines meeting, so...
Okay. No, okay, this picture might be misleading. I want to say a random light. Put some any light is here. The picture is not like it is. Let me draw one such light. Here are some vertices. Let's connect them.
Okay, so this is an example of one such lattice for n equal to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, n equal 5. And here you can have now a spin up, a spin down here, spin up, down, up. This will be one example of what I'm saying, okay? One random lattice. Okay, good. So how could it work? First of all, why did we choose such strange kinetic terms? Why the hell did I choose to mix it in this crazy way? And the reason is, of course, because I know what I want to get. And the idea is that I want to get correlation function between A fields. I want to get a propagator for these guys. I want to get an n0 result when I consider average of two Bs. But also when I consider A connected to a B. I have all these guys because the kinetic term is not diagonal. But let me tell you, if you compute the propagators, what do you get with this kinetic term? So you have to diagonalize and so on. And you get that this propagator is 1. This propagator is 1. This propagator is e to the minus beta j. Okay? Is it okay? Just telling you. This is why we chose this kinetic term. So, we will understand soon. This is why we chose that kinetic term. So let's now consider a typical one graph. Like for example, this one here. Okay? Now this could be one graph of the expansion of this guy. I have quartic vertices, and this is one graph. So now let's say that this matrix is a matrix A, this is a matrix A, this is a matrix B, this is a matrix A, this is a matrix B. This is my claim, that the matrix A, when I expand the matrix A, I want to identify it as being spin up. When I see a matrix B, I want to identify it with being spin down. Okay? So the idea is to identify A as being spin up, B as being a spin down. So what happens for this graph here? Whenever A connects with B, whenever I have an A connected to a B, I get a factor of e to the minus beta j. Right? So whenever an A connects to a B, I get a factor of e to the minus beta j. But this is exactly what I have here. We have e to the minus beta j for each spin down connected to a spin up. What? When I have an up and a down, this gives minus 1, this cancels this 2, and you get e to the minus beta j. So indeed, whenever I find a connection between an A and a B, here it is, A and a B, e to the minus beta j, A and a B, another e to the minus beta j, A to the B, another e to the minus beta j. And here, A to a A, nothing, just a 1. And so on. So all these interactions immediately come with the right weights. More, whenever I have a vertex A, it comes with this factor. It comes, a vertex A comes with e to the minus beta mu, e to the minus beta h. Why? Because it's here. And each vertex B, so this is A, each vertex B comes with e to the minus beta mu, e to the plus beta h. But this is exactly, again, what we expect for a spin up. So up contributes with e to the minus beta h, and a spin down with e to the plus beta h. And both up and down give e to the minus beta mu. Whenever I have a vertex, I have e to the minus beta mu. Doesn't matter if it's up or down. So great, whenever I have always e to the minus beta mu, always e to this, and then minus or plus depending on the two kinds of vertex. So that diagram has the correct magnetic field dependence, the correct spin coupling dependence, and the sum of all graphs, by definition of the planar limit, will have the correct genus expansion. And this is just a consequence of the planar limit. Right? Because we are in the planar limit, the leading graphs are n squared, the other ones n to the zero, and so on. Good. Very good. So, yes?
There you have a factor of n, right? So does the trace take care of that? Or?
Yes. And then, so this is normalized so that the so that when g is equal to zero, you start with n squared.
No, I meant the little n. Like
this one?
Yeah.
Good. So whenever you have e to the minus beta mu for each of them. Right? And then if you have small n of them, you get e to the minus beta mu times n. Right? In other words, this n is just the number, right?
Yeah.
The number of up plus the number of down. Okay, very good. So this is nice. It's neat that we have quantum gravity, statistical physics model, and so on, and they are, in fact, equivalent to matrix models. Now, this is even nicer, and this is one of the reasons why I'm telling you about matrix models, because matrix models are often exactly solvable. So, for example, we can compute the partition function of the randomizing model exactly, because we can use techniques of matrix models which made them exactly solvable. Quantum gravity in two dimensions can be solved exactly, because matrix models, again, can be solved exactly. Okay. And now, I want to show you what kind of tricks do we use to solve these matrix models exactly. I'm going to write an example of a quantity and the corresponding result, and then I'm going to derive that result. I think it's important for you to see the result. The derivation of the result, the kind of techniques, is not going to be used throughout the course, so if you want to have lunch, you can leave. But let me show you an example of some quantity, which a priori looks remarkable that we can compute it, but we can indeed. So I'm going to claim, because this quantity we will use it at some point in 1 week, let's suppose we want to compute the average, so we integrate over matrices, and we want to compute the average of this operator, 1 over n trace of e to the m. Okay? By e to the m, I mean 1 plus m squared plus m cubed, etc., with appropriate factorials. Okay? In the Gaussian matrix models, e to the minus 2 over g string. Okay, in this, I want to normalize it, 2 over g squared. Trace of m squared. Okay? Very good. Now, a priori, you see, we are doing, recall, these are n by n matrices. we are doing n-square Gaussian integrations. All of them are coupled. We have, in principle, to resum all these planar diagrams, non-planar, and so on. A priori, this is a difficult problem. Let me write you the exact result of this computation. This matrix model gives nothing but 1 over n times the Laguerre polynomials, 1, n minus 1. I'm going to define them. This is just a Laguerre polynomial. Of argument minus lambda over 4n, where now the convention I shift from g string to g square. So lambda is g square times n. So it depends on this parameter, lambda over 4n, e to the lambda over 8. This is the final result. Let me define the Laguerre polynomial. But let me first tell you what is the expansion when I expand this in at large n, keeping lambda fixed. I get 2 over square root of lambda, I1 over square root of lambda, plus lambda over 48 n square, I2 of square root of lambda, plus dot, dot, dot. So these i's are Bessel functions. These ones, they are simple. And you see what we achieved. What I'm telling you, that we are able to compute all planar diagrams and to resum the result. And here we have all torus diagrams. I'm telling you that it's possible. You sum, you write all planar diagrams, I mean, I have infinitely many, and then you can resum them, and you get this nice Bessel function. And you can indeed, you can even do it for finite n and lambda, which is this Laguerre polynomial, even better. What is this Laguerre, finally? This Laguerre polynomials with n and m, they are defined as 1 over n factorial, from e to the x, x to the minus m, n derivatives. This is the kind of definition that you have for Hermite polynomials. It's e to the minus x, x to the n plus m. So you see it's a polynomial because this e to the x is never killed, and there is an e to the x here with opposite sign. So this time this is 1, and at the end you get some polynomial. Okay, very good. So I don't know if Callum warned you that I'm going over time today. I want to ask you if it's clear that this is a hard problem a priori. I expand. I have to compute. I have here infinitely many vertices downstairs, 1, m, m square, m cube, and so on. I'm computing all these averages, resumming everything, and this is the kind of thing that we can do. This is one example. I could have done the two matrix model partition function. I chose this example because it turns out that this computation will be useful much later. But this is just one example to illustrate how can we solve matrix models. Is this conceptually clear? What did we achieve? Okay, again, now I'm going to derive it. Okay, I hope you are not hungry. Again, feel free to leave. This is the derivation. I think it's quite neat. It contains some tricks that you might find useful in the future. But for the understanding of the rest of this exploration in string theory course, it's not crucial. Very good. So the goal is to derive this expression. Okay. So first of all, there's something that should make us suspicious. N times n is too much. N squared is a bit too much, right? Because we have lots of gauge symmetry. So, in fact, we are integrating over m, but then we say that m, that we have this symmetry, m going to u, m, u minus 1. This is a symmetry. This is some huge symmetry. So if I have some matrix m, then I could as well have u times m times u minus 1 and get a completely different matrix. So what would be the more invariant data to work with? What is the nicer set of variables that I should expect to use instead of these n by n matrices? Sorry? I think you said it correctly. Right, so what is left in, what is invariant when I make such transformations? The eigenvalues of m. They are not transformed. So indeed, we expect to be able to go to, from m to its eigenvalues lambda I. And here we have n variables. And here we have n squared variables. Indeed, this action, which depends on m, which is e to the minus trace of m square, okay, right, is nothing but e to the minus 1 over 2g square sum over I of lambda I square. You agree? Is it clear to everyone? I can diagonalize my matrix, right? I can replace this m by u, some diagonal matrix, u minus 1 times u, diagonal matrix, u minus 1. And inside the trace, I just keep diagonal times diagonal, which is just sum of diagonal square. So indeed, the action only depends on the eigenvalues. So it's very natural. So we want to change, to compute, let's say this is alpha. We somehow want to replace, in this we want to replace dm by d lambda 1, d lambda n. Does someone want to complain at this point? Normal? You mean diagonal? No.
You can, they are emission, you can always diagonalize them. Yeah, so you can diagonalize them, but is this something reasonable to do? Yes?
You have matrices that have the same spectrum, but they are still different.
Right, but then there is gauge symmetry, then they should be identified, because everything is equivalent, you have this symmetry. It's like having gauge fields, a gauge field. If you have two gauge fields which differ by a gauge transformation, you should identify them, they are the same. How will, in QCD, or in quantum electrical dynamics, or anywhere, can we just say, I fixed this gauge, and that's it, I integrate it over now the A, but with this gauge fixed? We typically need to take care of the measure. There is a Jacobian from a change of variable. Right? So it's not that straightforward. We need to take care of the measure. So what happens is that, indeed, this can be done, but there is a Jacobian delta square, which depends on lambda.
This is a Jacobian. Which is what exactly what Eduardo was saying. So let me remind you about how to derive this. This is the Fadev-Popov trick. Did you hear? Yeah? So does everyone know how to gauge fix the matrix to be diagonal? Or should I do it?
Probably better to do it. So let's do. So we have some integral over matrices M, some
gauge invariant function f of m. So f of m is all this. All this is f of m. Okay. Now I want to define. So I want to define one to be equal to the integral dn lambda I, this d lambda 1 up to d lambda n, du, and then delta of n square u m u dagger minus lambda. Lambda is this diagonal matrix with the lambdas. Times this Jacobian delta square of lambda. Okay? This is definition of this delta square. Okay? Let me remind you how this trick goes. Now what we do is we insert this one here. Okay? So this is definition of delta square. Now let's insert that one there. Okay. Then what happens is that this becomes the integral. Now I exchange this du integral dm integral dn lambda f. This matrix, this f of m, as we saw, actually it's f of lambda, so I can replace this f by f of lambda. Okay. Delta square of lambda, by definition, times this delta of n square u m u minus 1 minus lambda. Very good. Now we do the usual trick with Aleph Popov. We say that this is just some rotation of the matrix, so I can call this M tilde. Now, dm, when I change from dm to dm tilde, what happens? Nothing. It's just rotation, right? So dm goes to dm tilde. So here, for each fixed u, dm I can just replace by dm tilde with no measure. It's just a rotation. Okay? But then I have dm tilde. M tilde only appears here. M tilde just becomes diagonal. And the integration over m tilde just disappears. Right? So this integration over m tilde just kills this delta function and disappears. And u disappeared out of the game. U doesn't appear anymore, so it just gives a volume of un. So this becomes something, it's an integral du, which just factorizes. We can normalize this so that this is 1, times integral d for lambda, f of lambda, delta square of lambda. So let me repeat the logic. If we define delta in this way, then with this definition, we can indeed go from here to here. Okay? So if we define delta in this way, we know how to go from m to lambda. So this is step one. Step two is, okay, using this definition, let's then compute delta. Okay? So this definition justifies the passage from integral over the m, from integral to eigenvalue. So we are done. So next, we need to use this definition to compute delta. Yes?
Shouldn't it be
before? Okay, good. So let's compute then. Let's compute this delta, which is a Fadev-Popov determinant. Let me remind you how do you compute it. Okay, so we have 1 is equal to integral dn lambda I du delta of n square u m u minus 1 minus lambda delta square of lambda. Okay, very good. Now, for a generic M, okay, which we can write always as
U naught inverse lambda prime U naught. So this is a generic M. I can always diagonalize it. So this matrix is not lambda. This is lambda 1 prime, lambda n prime. Okay? For a generic matrix, I have here some diagonal guy, some other diagonal guy. A generic U will be different than U naught and will not give me 0 inside delta function. Right? So for a generic matrix M, U will not give U M U dagger minus lambda equal to 0. Of course, it will be very far. I mean, I have some matrix. Only if U is close to U naught. If U is close to U naught, then okay. Then U cancels U naught, and I have some chances of getting diagonal minus diagonal equals 0. Yes? So we can expand around U equal to U naught. So we can write that U is equal to 1 plus T, T something small, times U naught. Okay? So only these guys matter. Otherwise, I have 0 on the delta function, and I don't care. Okay, very good. Now, if we do it, and if we plug it here, what we get is the following. So we expand, we put this, and we expand. And then U M U dagger is U minus 1, sorry. They are just unitary matrices. U M U minus 1 will be equal, if we expand then, to lambda prime, okay, plus, sorry, it will be equal to U, just 1 second, U naught cancels this, yes. It will be equal to lambda prime plus commutator of T with lambda prime. Okay? It's a question of expanding. Putting U dagger as a minus, it's U inverse, and you get this. Okay, very good. So now, this guy, since I'm expanding, this is... So what happens is the following. Lambda prime is diagonal, okay? And T is not diagonal. Otherwise, I would get here 0. So T is off-diagonal. And these guys will be off-diagonal matrix elements, while this guy contains only diagonal matrix elements. So then, this delta function, the delta of n square, factorizes into, I have to impose that the diagonal elements cancel and the off-diagonal elements cancel. So I get that delta of n square of tatak-tak, which is there, becomes delta lambda minus lambda prime and delta of commutator of T with lambda prime. Okay? And what we had to compute, I remind you, was 1, which was equal to the integral dn lambda. Then there is integration over T, which is just over U, which now is T, dTij. And then we have times this, times delta square of lambda. And now something nice. Now lambda is set to be equal to lambda prime because of this delta function. So here I can put lambda prime and then take it out of the integral. So I get 1 is equal to delta square of lambda prime integral only over the Tij elements. Okay. Product over I smaller than j. And then if I work out explicitly the components, this is what I get of delta of Tij, delta square of Tij times lambda j minus lambda I. Just working out the components of this commutator. T times lambda or lambda times T, the index becomes either contracted with this one when it's T times lambda, or when it's lambda times T, it becomes contracted in this way. And why delta 2? Because this is delta of the real part of tau 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 times delta of the imaginary part of tac tac tac. Okay? And this D is again, this is over the real and the imaginary part of T. When I write this, this is D real part of Tij, D imaginary part of Tij. Okay, very good. Now it's very simple to compute. For each Tij, right? For each Tij, Tij is multiplied by this lambda, lambda j minus lambda I. So I rescale, and I take out this factor, and then I just get the integral of delta function, which is 1. Right? So in other words, we conclude that 1 is equal to delta square of lambda prime over product over I smaller than j, lambda I prime minus lambda j prime square. And therefore, we derive that lambda, that the Jacobian, which depends on lambda, is equal to the product over I smaller than j, lambda I minus lambda j. See, not a completely trivial Jacobian. It's something that we have to compute. And this is the final result. And this is called the van der Mond determinant. It appears in many, many places. Okay. Any question here? This is just a left pop off, but
T square root.
No, each T I rescaled by lambda minus lambda prime. So whenever I have a dt, I get dt over that, and then that I can take out.
I mean, the very last one is that a product of lambda I minus lambda j all squared.
Yeah, here there is square, and here there is square, so
there's a product.
Yes? A product of squares is square of product.
Oh, right, yeah.
Okay, so this is how we derive. So we conclude that our object, the guy that we wanted to compute, we reduced it to n variables, but with a funny Jacobian. So we concluded that indeed integral dm of some gauge invariant f of m is equal to integral dn lambda delta square of lambda times f of lambda. Good. This is the first great simplification. Now we are integrating only over gauge invariant data. Okay, very good. So now our goal is to compute this n integrations. So we did n squared to n. Now we need to compute it. But first of all, any question here? Why is this called a van der Mond determinant? Why determinant? Doesn't look like a determinant. Because it can be written as a determinant. Delta square of lambda, delta lambda, is equal to the determinant over a matrix which has index I and j, which is nothing but lambda I to the j minus 1. Okay? Let's see why. So what I'm saying is that this is equal to the determinant of the matrix which has elements 1, 1, 1, 1, then lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda n, lambda 1 square, lambda 2 square, lambda 3 square, lambda n square, etc. Okay, let me write the last column. Lambda 1 to the n minus 1, lambda 2 n minus 1, lambda 3 n minus 1, lambda n to the power n minus 1. Okay? This is the claim, that this, which was just product over I smaller than j, lambda I minus lambda j, is equal to this determinant. And this is why it's called the van der Mond determinant. Van der Mond likes this determinant.
Why is this true? Any idea? How do you prove such thing? If it was 3 by 3, if n was equal to 3, how would you prove it? I hope I taught you something.
If that beginning of the year. Put it in mathematics, of course. Very good. That's why my fortunary can. So let me put the exercise, check n equals 3. Which is a bit stupid after we prove the general case. But okay, let's prove the general case. How do we prove our general n? Any idea? I want one proposal.
Induction.
Sorry?
Induction.
Induction is a possibility. Yeah, another one. Okay, but I said I only want to do one. So the idea is very simple. So we want to prove that product over I smaller than j, lambda I minus lambda j, is equal to the determinant of lambda I with j minus 1. So the proof is very simple. And it's just left hand side and right hand side are both 1 polynomials, right? With the determinant of this, you have a polynomial in the lambdas. There is a polynomial as well. Okay, I don't need one. Are both polynomials with the same degree. Zeros and large lambda I behavior. Hence, they are the same. Okay? The idea is, yeah, two polynomials, they behave in the same way when one is very large, they have the same zeros, they must be the same.
Why do they have the same zeros? Let's start by the same zeros. Because the large lambda behavior automatically gives a good degree. This guy is zero when any lambda is equal to another lambda, right? What about this one also? Because when lambda is equal to another lambda, two rows of the determinant become equal and you get zero. Okay? So the determinant is equal to zero when lambda I is equal to lambda j, because you have the determinant of two equal rows. Good, so it has the same zeros. That's done. You can also see that it's anti-symmetric, this one. When you change I and j, you get minus sign. Here, when you change I and j, you interchange two columns, and indeed, you pick a minus sign. But let's just check the large lambda behavior. Let's say lambda 1 goes to infinity. From the left-hand side, it's clear what happens. Whenever I have lambda 1 minus lambda 2, lambda 1 minus lambda 3, lambda 1 minus lambda whatever, I pick these terms with lambda 1 and I keep only the highest power of lambda 1. Right? So I pick lambda 1 to the power n minus 1, which comes from lambda 1 minus lambda 2 times lambda 1 minus lambda 3 times lambda 1 minus lambda 4, etc. And then I'm left with the rest, which is product over I smaller than j, but I is bigger than 1, so I is at least 2. Of lambda I minus lambda j. And this is nothing but the Vandermonde determinant with n minus 1 and without lambda 1. What about from the right-hand side point of view? From the right-hand side, I look here and I take lambda 1 to be very large. But what does it mean? It means that when I develop the determinant starting from the first row, I want to start by this guy. Right? But I start by this guy, and what am I left? With a smaller determinant. Right? So from the determinant point of view, we pick this one, lambda 1 to the n minus 1, times this determinant here. So I get exactly lambda 1 to the n minus 1 times this delta, n minus 1, lambda 2 up to lambda n. Okay? So this finishes the proof. So they are the same. Very good. So basically, what we want to compute is the following. Let's write what we want to compute. So the average of 1 over n e to the m is nothing, but one over z integral product over I d lambda I up to n. Then we have this van der Mond here, which we can write as determinant lambda I to the power j minus 1, I and j. This van der Mond appears squared. And then we have e to the lambda 1, e to the minus 2 over g squared, sum from I equal to 1 up to n, lambda I square. So you would normally get 1 over n sum over I e to the lambda I if you compute the trace. I mean, of course, gauge invariant stuff I was always emphasizing. The trace of this is the sum of those exponentials, right? But each average of lambda 1, lambda 2, etc., they are, of course, all equivalent. So I can just put lambda 1 and kill the 1 over n, right? Each term of this sum gives, of course, the same. So this is what we want. So this is our goal, is to compute this n-dimensional integral. So now I'm going to use another super cool trick. So it's important that everyone understands what's going on up to here. So is everyone happy? Yes. Sorry?
The one plus expression from the NP runs inside equals.
Yeah.
The one of the two, the one going on to the end minus one, we have minus one to the end.
Yeah, that's right. There might be an oval minus sign.
Another question?
Huh?
In the last step there, where you said when you're doing a large n behavior and you.
Yes.
Haven't you assumed what you want to prove? You said that that lower determinant is, you know, delta n minus 1 lambda cube, but isn't that what you're trying to prove?
Well, but that's clear, right? So, do you agree that I keep this term?
Yeah.
And then I get the determinant of this?
Yeah.
Right? But what is the determinant of this? It's the. Okay, I understand what you're saying. Okay. Okay, so then I would have to prove my induction. Okay, going now. Got it. So sorry. So let's see. What Trevor was saying is that here I get delta written a la left hand side. And here I got delta written a la right hand side. I didn't prove yet that they are the same. So I do need to continue going now. Sorry. Good point. Yeah, good.
Alternatively, it's enough to show that, there is an even simpler way. You just need to show that you have the good antisymmetry properties, and then you pick, so since you have all the good antisymmetry properties, all the good zeros, up to a number, they must be right. So instead of computing the large lambda behavior, you can pick, say, some diagonal here, and then find that the diagonal comes with a 1 or minus 1, because when you multiply these factors, it can only come with 1 or minus 1. So then up to a sign, they ought to be the same. Okay? So antisymmetry and zeros tells you that they are the same up to a number. Then you pick one coefficient, and you check that that number is plus or minus 1. Okay, very good. So we want to compute this integral. Let me do something. Do you allow? Let me do something. Let me write it. Sorry. 1 over z integral product d lambda I up to n determinant of lambda I to the j minus 1 square e to the g square over square root of 2 lambda 1 e to the minus sum of lambda I square. I just rescaled the fields. Notice that I can do it. I rescale the fields, I rescale up and down. I mean, this doesn't matter. Okay? Whatever factors come from this, cancel with the ones that come from here and so on. I can do whatever rescalings I want. So I just rescaled the fields to put this like this. Now, here comes a super cool trick, which is the following. Notice that we have this determinant. And I want to say that if I pick some row here, I have some row here, so some lambda, lambda 1 to the power j minus 1, tak, 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 lambda n up to the power j minus 1. So let's focus on this row here. Okay? In this row, we can replace lambda I to the j minus 1 by any polynomial of degree j minus 1 of lambda I, provided it starts at lambda I to the j minus 1 plus whatever times lambda I j minus 2 plus tak tak tak. Why is this true? Why can I do it? Sorry? Because the other pieces give zero, because this one here, lambda I to j minus 2, appears here already. So it's a linear combination of the previous row. So I can, of course, to each column, sorry, sum any linear combination of the other columns. Right? So it's very remarkable. Instead of lambda I can choose whatever polynomial I want of lambda j minus 1. That's why this form with a determinant is so powerful. So let's do it. Let's do this funny trick. And let's choose very intelligent polynomials. So, yeah? Sure. So if you have, say, let's see a simple case. 1, 1, 1, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda 1 square, lambda 2 square, lambda 3 square. Right? You can add this, you can add to this guy any linear combination of these two, and you get the same result. So you can add, you can say this is the same as 1, 1, 1, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. And here you can put lambda 1 square plus alpha lambda 1 plus beta, lambda 2 square plus alpha lambda 2 plus beta, lambda 3 square plus alpha lambda 3 plus beta. And the result is exactly the same. Because all you did was sum alpha times this guy and beta times this guy. So it means that whenever I find some column, I can replace by any polynomial, provided it starts with the correct power. So this is really awesome, because now we can choose the polynomial which simplifies our computation. So now, okay, sorry, let me continue here. Now this, we replace this by the determinant of polynomial of degree j minus 1 of lambda I. Everything squared. There is the square here. Okay, good. So now I want a proposal for what polynomials to use. What polynomials will you choose? What polynomials do you know? You don't know that many. Come on, polynomials with names of someone.
Laguerre polynomials.
Polynomials? No. I don't know. Why would I choose Laguerre polynomials?
Because
you said them earlier. But you know other polynomials. What other polynomials do you know? Good. Let's also know his thoughts. More. Hermite. Why isn't it a great idea?
We want to turn that integral into a Gaussian integral, right?
Well, it's related to the Gaussian. Not exactly what you're saying. But why is Hermite a great choice? Because their heat polynomials are orthogonal with respect to the Gaussian measure. Right? So let me remind you that if you define, let this be the Hermite polynomials, h, n of x, okay? Let this guy be normalized to be x to the n plus tak tak tak. Then I want to change a bit the normalization. Notice that changing a bit the normalization, once again, I can do it. It just amounts to redefining this c. So I can also, I don't even need to start at 1. And we have a nice normalization that we normalize in this way. 1 over square root, 2 to the n, n factorial square root of 5. And let me call this our polynomial, Pn of x. Then this polynomial has something great. Integral dx from minus infinity to plus infinity e to the minus x squared times Pn of x is just delta nf.
So great choice of this polynomials. Because now, if I put these polynomials here, okay, I have this determinant, okay, and I have product of these two determinants, right? So almost all terms, so I have now to compute the determinant of this polynomial p I of lambda j over, okay, times the determinant times another one, it's squared. So times determinant, let's use some different letters of compute pk of lambda s. Okay? And then we have all these integrals, d lambda 1, ta ta ta, d lambda n, and then the rest of the stuff there. Now let's focus on the integration over lambda 2, for example. When I expand these determinants, I get one polynomial of lambda 2, which multiplies another polynomial of lambda 2. Right? What happens if the polynomials are not the same? Zero. So lambda 2 integration, let me be more explicit here. Here I get e to the minus lambda 2 squared, e to the minus lambda 3 squared, e to the minus lambda n squared, and then lambda 1 is a bit different. E to the minus lambda 1 squared plus lambda 1 over square root of 2 with some g squared, oh, follow this. Yeah, like that. But let's focus on all these guys. All these guys can be done. Because whenever I find some lambda, say lambda 2, the polynomial from lambda 2 from here and the polynomial from lambda 2 from here must be the same. Okay? And then from lambda 3, I see again, they must be the same. So when I expand these determinants and do all these integrations, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda n, I'm left only with the integration of lambda 1. Good? So please follow my argument. Now, since I use all polynomials, since I married all polynomials, the one with lambda 1, which is left to do, because it's the only unmarried one, must also be the same. Because I married, say, p5 with p5 of lambda, for lambda 3, and so on, and at the end, the one for lambda 1 must be the same. So what I get is, all the integrals lambda 2 and so on I can do, I get a sum from j equal to 0 up to n minus 1, of integral d lambda 1 p j of lambda 1 square e to the minus lambda 1 square plus, sorry, here lambda 1, plus lambda 1 over square root of 2 g square. So one integral. One integral to the one. Okay? So the integral of a lambda 2, lambda 3, and so on, I can all do by orthogonality. Any question here?
The value of the other integrals
give 1. All other integrals give 1. So I just give 1, and then I just have to sum over which one was the 1 over... over lambda 1. And now, this is equal to a sum over j, because it's one integral, so basically the result is done. This is what it is. But actually, this is nothing, but this integral is nothing but the integral representation of the Laguerre polynomial. So, but again, it's one integral, so it's done. Now it's just names. So this is nothing but sum from j equal to 0 up to n. Now I'm writing the final result. E to the lambda over 8 n l 0 j of minus lambda over 4 n. And this sum of Laguerre polynomials using the definition can be done. And it is just 1 over n log f n minus 1, 1 of minus lambda over 4 n e to the lambda over 8 n. And this guy can be expanded. And you have 2 over square root lambda times I1 of square root lambda plus 1 over n square times lambda over, I wrote already this, 48 pi square
I to square root lambda plus tak tak tak. Notice how remarkable is what we managed to do. We managed to compute it exactly for any n and lambda, any coupling, and then we can expand and get all planar diagrams, all torus diagrams, and so on, in as a particular case. Okay, I'll prepare a tutorial with what I want us to continue, because I think I went slightly over time. So, any question? So let me just one comment about what I wanted to do. You see that we got a very nice result. We got some simple results for the planar, the torus, and so on. So you might ask, what if I just want the sum of all planar diagrams? Is there another way of going directly and getting only the planar diagrams? Is there a way of jumping there more directly? In other words, I want the leading value when n is very large. Okay? So when n is very large, what happens is that actually this integral here, okay, in that case it's better to keep the van der Monte in the usual way, product over I smaller than j. And then that product of I smaller than j, let's put it in the exponent as a sum of up to n of log of lambda I minus lambda j. And then you see, you have an exponent with a huge number of terms. N goes to infinity, so you have a sum of many, many terms. So you have a huge exponent. Because you have a huge exponent, you can use saddle points. So when n goes to infinity, you can see what's the configuration of eigenvalues that dominates this integral by saddle point. And then you end up directly on the Bessel function. Okay? So I will prepare a tutorial where you do this computation. Starting from this integral, localizing it by saddle points, just studying what is the stationary point of the exponent when you put everything in the exponent, and then you can see that you end up directly with the Bessel function. And this technique of the polynomial is called the technique of orthogonal polynomials for matrix models. It's probably the most powerful one. Okay, thank you. Let's continue.